So
what I talked about last time was this idea of trying to do calculations with logical expressions. And what I did is I made up this little very simplified language where you have an accumulator, software board now, and you have a set of variables and you can do various kinds of logical combinations on them, store the values and move the values around. And I didn't quite say why I was doing that, I just kind of did it and showed you what it was about. But the main idea of doing things this way is that it gives us a way of taking complicated expressions or programs and turning them into tiny little steps, each of which we can implement directly in the circuitry of a computer. And so that I want to at least get you, at the end of today, get you to the point of appreciating why that's being done, what that actually accomplishes, why this is such a powerful idea that we can build on top of. So the main issue that we need to address, the main gap between where we are now and understanding how that works, I think, is this idea of memory. There's two ways that we need to use memory in order to implement this machine. One is we need a place to store that list of instructions. Okay, we need some way of having the computer have access to, or the machine that we're building have access to that list of instructions, so that it can look one up and do what it has to say and then move on to the next one. And so we're going to store those instructions in a memory. The other way that memory comes into play here is we have that set of the Boolean variables, A through P. And we need a place to store all those values. We're going to have a different memory storage for just the Boolean variables. So here's what I want you to know about how memory works. So memory is just a circuit, just like the kind of circuits that we've been talking about, like big AND gates or what was it? The equal 5 that we talked about on the homework and in lecture. Here's how a memory circuit works. And computers actually have things like this in them, so they actually are fairly significant. It's a big circuit, big gray box, that takes in as input, essentially, an address. Which memory element do we want right now? It takes the content of all those addresses, the content of the entire memory as input. Then what it's going to output is whatever is stored in the memory address that it was given. And the way that it does that is actually very, very simple. All it's doing is saying, okay, there's a whole bunch of little boxes inside this big box. And what the little boxes do, each little box is in charge of storing, or at least dealing with, one little piece of the memory. So this little box that I blew up to make bigger is the content of memory address number 21. And so what its job is it just sits there and it listens to the address. And if that address is exactly equal to the number 21, then it wakes up and then outputs whatever the content of its memory is. Okay, it actually goes and it only is responsible for 21 here. It takes whatever the input to that is and produces it as output only if the given address matches the number 21. Meanwhile, if let's say there's 32 different memory places in this memory, there's 31 other boxes just like that, one listening for the address 0, one listening for the address 1, one listening for the address 2, all the way up to 31. And each of them is going to output their contents of their memory if the address matches. And so they all output what they have to say to this giant OR gate. And if anybody has anything to say, their input goes through and comes out the output, and everything else is ignored. And that's really all it's doing. It's just doing this giant lookup, which consists of a whole bunch of repeated, very simple patterns. So there's the details of exactly how this is implemented, which you could step through, but I don't think it's very important right now. The main thing that I want you to understand is just the idea that what the memory is that it's a giant box that you say, okay, you ask it, what's in address 13? And that's what comes out the other side. So it just holds on to a whole bunch of different bit patterns. And whenever you ask it, it gives you the bit pattern corresponding to whichever one you asked for. So it's like a giant registrar's office, right? It's just holding on to the data, and it's just ready to answer whenever you want, though mainly between the hours of 9 and 5. Okay, so this is what a memory circuit does. Now this alone wouldn't be enough, right? If all we had in the computer was just this giant box that whenever you asked it for what number was stored in that box, it would tell you, it wouldn't be that useful because you would never be able to change what was in the box. So we also need to be able to write into the memory. And writing is basically the reverse of this. All right. So,
take that forward. That's what the memory circuit would look like if you drew it instead of with boxes with in Python. The writing ends up being basically the opposite. There's a little writing box in each of these, and now the writing memory circuit does something different. It takes in the address that you want to change, the new value that you want to change it to, and the content of the memory, and it produces as output an updated version of the memory. So this is going to be the same as what came in the input everywhere, except for the one place that matches the address that you gave it, and that new value will be whatever you set new value to be. So you can basically tell it, so this is a memory circuit for reading, this is a memory circuit for writing. The memory circuit for writing, you tell it the address and you tell it what value you want it to have. 7, something like that. Or since they're really bits, 0111, say. Okay. And what comes out the other side here is what now belongs in each box of the memory, which again is going to be the same everywhere except for the one place that matches that address. This information is going to get fed back around the next time, and that way we'll have those same values available if we want to do any additional work on that. All right, so once we have a notion of memory, now we can actually create, the values go back. Now we have the possibility of storing values for the Boolean variables and also all the instructions that are going to be making up the program. I mentioned before how these instructions like I equals accumulator and I, each of the instructions that we can possibly write, we can write with a little 7-bit pattern. And the details of how that, I made this up, right? So this is not something that anybody ever know. But just the idea that you can take a set of instructions and give each of them a code so that these codes can actually be turned into something that actually causes that instruction to happen. That's the main thing I want to get across. The set of instructions that a given computer allows is called its instruction set. And I'll say a little bit more about real instruction sets in a minute. This is my own little fake instruction set just to illustrate the point. I'll say a little bit more about this. Let me say that the way that I tried to set up the instruction set for this particular computer to keep it simple and sufficiently powerful is I use the first bit of every instruction to say whether or not this is a command that's going to write a value into the accumulator, which is called a load, or if we're going to write a value into one of the variables, that's called a store. So we have one bit that determines whether this command is a load or a store. Then there are two bits that say, well, are we oring something, are we anding something, are we nodding something, are we not nodding something? Those are the four possibilities. And then the remaining four bits, one, two, three, four bits, say which variable it is that we're acting on, A, B, C, D, all the way up to P. So if we wanted to encode a command like let store into I the value that's currently in the accumulator anded with whatever is currently in I, that's going to be a store command, which is an AND. It uses the variable I, which is 1000, and so we stick those bits together, and it's 1011000. Every combination of bits creates some instruction. Any instruction that's in this collection of possible instructions has some way of encoding it in terms of the bits. All right, I created a program that actually does this. And let me say a little bit about what the interface to this program looks like. So let's see how this goes. So we've got, how much room did I use for instructions? I think there was the memory for instructions, I think, can hold 32 different instructions, starting with instruction 0. So instruction 0 is this bind, well, okay, so the instruction 0 through instruction 8 are visible on the screen now. You can store whatever you want in these. At the moment, the first instruction is 0110011, which if you look back at the last slide and you step through what this is, I actually have the decoding next to it. It's the command store into the accumulator the value of, this is 11, that's a not command, on 0011, that's the decimal number 3, so that's the letter D. A is 0, B is 1, C is 2, D is 3. So this sequence of bits actually makes the command accumulator equals not D. Take whatever's in D, invert it, store it in the accumulator. All right. If you interpret this same sequence of bits as a decimal number, it would be the number 51. 51 is sort of easier for us to wrap our heads around than this bit pattern, so I have 51 written as a separate entry here. So the content of the first memory location storing the program has these bits in it, but you can also look at these bits as an instruction, and you can also look at these bits as a decimal number. And so I've got three columns with all those three different ways of seeing that. All right, so this is the address. This is the contents of memory written as decimal, the contents of memory written as binary, the contents of memory written as an instruction. Then that's not the whole machine. We also have all the Boolean variables from A to P, and each one stores exactly one bit. So here's the bits associated with each of those values. That's part of what is in my little computer that I'm creating. We have this accumulator that I mentioned before. The accumulator can either be true or false. The moment it's false. And then we've got one other piece that I haven't talked about. This is the PC piece, which doesn't stand for politically correct, and it does not stand for personal computer. It stands for program counter. And it refers to which addresses instruction are we going to execute next? So it's basically, and I have it marked here with the red box, it's basically saying, where are we in the sequence of instructions that we're executing? And this is exactly the sort of state that you would keep. If I gave you a sheet of instructions and said, execute these instructions, you would need to keep that sheet, because otherwise you'd lose the instructions. You need to keep what's in all the variables, A through P. You need to keep track of where you currently are, which instructions you've already executed. And we have this special accumulator, you need to know that. So this is the state of this computer. It's exactly what you'd expect you'd need to keep track of if you were doing this by hand. All right, and so then I've got a button called cycle. When I hit that, it executes the current instruction, changes the value of the variable, increments the program counter so it goes to the next instruction, and then animates that by moving the box down to the next part, and it's ready to execute the next instruction. All right? So let's see if this actually works. We don't really need P, do we?
Yes, we do.
We kind of do. All right, well, I'll slide it back over as we need it. We don't really need the instruction numbers now. It kind of helps to have instruction numbers. All right, so here's what we've got. If you had a very, very small computer that can only execute these instructions, and you had a special device that you could peer inside and look at the circuitry, it would look something like this. Not the circuitry, but the values and all the state variables. All right, so let's kind of do this by hand. This is I asked you to do this a couple times already, actually executing these statements. So let's do this together, make sure that we kind of see how this is supposed to work. So at the moment, we're about to execute the first instruction, which is the accumulator gets not the value of D. Let's see, so D, the variable D currently has a zero in it. The accumulator currently is false. So what's going to happen? The accumulator is going to take We're going to take the value of D, which is 0. We're going to not it. 0 becomes a 1. 1 becomes a 0. So this is a 0. It's going to become a 1. We're going to store that value in the accumulator. So the accumulator should become 1. Or since we're writing it as true or false, true. Good. All right. So when we hit cycle and it causes it to actually execute this command, that's what should happen. Woo! Now, that's not the only thing that happened. Like, yeah, I spent 4 hours making this program that just changes false to true. That's not the only thing to happen. Also, the value of the program counter clicked up to 1. And you can see it's now saying that it's ready to execute the next statement. The next statement says, take whatever's in the accumulator, which is now true, and with whatever's in B, which is currently true or 1, take the AND of those two things and store it in the accumulator. So now the accumulator should become, it should stay true. Woohoo! Nothing changed. All right, next statement. Next statement says, P gets the accumulator. So I'm going to slide this over a little bit. So what should happen when we execute this command is the value in the accumulator, true, should get stored into variable P. Woohoo! All right. Moving on. So we'll kind of fast click through. If you're not sure about how any of these work, let me know. But you should be able to watch. The values are actually changing up there in the top. The accumulator is occasionally flipping values. The program counter is stepping up. When all is said and done, we should get to the end. All right, we've wrapped back around to the beginning. Yes?
The values that you're looking for, A, B, C, you just randomly put like 0, 1, 0, whatever, or do they make sense?
Right, so that's what I'm going to explain now. Good question. All right, so it turns out that what this little program does is it's exactly what we had in the slides that we talked about last time. We're adding two 2-bit numbers. The 2-bit numbers are stored. How are they stored? Oh, darn. One moment. I think it's A, B is the first number and C, D is the second number. But let's, just to not lead anybody astray. Yeah, A, B, so this is what's happening. We're adding A, B, and C, D. As temporary variables, we need to keep the carry bits, which turn out that we're going to have E as this carry bit and F as this carry bit. And then the answer that it's producing is going to be stored in G, H, I. All right, so it's not there anymore. Let's actually check this. All right, so A, B is 1, 1. C, D is 1, 0. All right, so let's actually go through that process and add these guys together. So 1 plus 0 is 1 with no carry. 0 plus 1 plus 1 is 0 with a carry of 1. So let's just to check this. This is a 2. This is a, no, sorry. That's a 3. This is a 2. 3 plus 2 is 5. This is 4 plus 1 is 5. Okay, so this is what we want to have happen. Now let's actually check. What's in EF? E, at the end of this, E has a 1 and F has a 0. Kind of bad equal signs. This was A, this was B, this was C, this was D, this is G, H, I. And did it work? Did G, H, I have 1, 0, 1? G, H, I. 1, 0, 1. Whew! Okay, so now I could have faked all that, right? So let's try this. There's one other little part of the interface that I didn't tell you about. If you actually click on any of the bits in the memory, it causes them to flip. So let's set everything to 0 for a moment. We're back at the beginning anyway. What two-bit numbers would we like to add together? That's a good idea. How about the second number?
1, 1.
1, 1.
And
what? Okay. All right. So that means we need to set A to 1 and B to 1. That's the number 3 for the first number we're adding. C to 1 and D to 1. That's the other number 3 that we're adding. And we expect at the end of this, this is really what? This is 3 plus 3 is 6, which ought to look something like 4, 2, 1. GHI should hold 1, 1, 0 if the sum worked. And back. All right. GHI, 1, 1, 0. All right. So it actually added 3 and 3, got 6. The excitement is palpable. All right. So it worked. And in fact, what this is actually doing is very directly implementing the circuits that we figured out last time for, okay, the carry bit given these other bits should be this and this, but not this, and the next carry should be this, and the final value should be equal to that. And I just made the series of commands that actually caused that to happen. It turned out, by tremendous stroke of luck, that there were exactly 32 commands needed to make that happen. Yeah?
I don't get why you said 3 and 3.
You don't know why 3 plus 3 equals 6?
No, I mean, like, how is 1 equal 3?
AB is 1, we just picked 1, 1. Which in binary is the number 3, right? It's 2 plus a 1.
Okay.
So CD was the same. That was also 3.
Oh, I thought you meant like the first column was 3 and 3. That's why I was confused.
Ah, right. No, so what I'm doing here is I took these first two variables to be a number. I interpreted them as a number.
I thought you meant CD equals 6. That's why I was surprised.
Yes. Okay. Good. Yes.
Can we add more than 2 bits?
Not with this. Not with this. Yeah, so and which is a little irritating, right? Could you imagine, oh, you need 3 bits added today and you have to build a Holman computer. It turned out that just because I kind of guessed early on that I wouldn't need more than, so you know, some computers are like, have 256K, is it, what do computers have now? It's like megs and gigs now, right? You can have, oh yeah, so this computer now has a gig, so a billion bytes. I upgraded it with the help of him from half a gig, which was 512 meg. That's 512 places that you can store stuff in the memory. This computer has 32 places you can store things. Not 32 meg, not 32 gig, not 32k, 32, just 32 places. If I wanted to make it, say, have 64 places or like a whole k, 1,000 places, first of all, the display would have gotten very big. But then I would have needed my PC, the program counter would have needed to be able to store numbers up to that value. Since I only went up to 32, I only needed a program counter that had 5 bits, because with 5 bits you can get all the way up to 31. So I kind of just picked the number up at the beginning. If I recreated all of this with a larger possibility of a larger memory, like this is a 5-bit memory, people talk now about 64-bit memories, and I guess that's probably as high as people go these days. With 64 bits, you can address like 18 billion billion, something like that. You have a lot more different instructions, so you can have much more complicated procedures. With the 32 instructions, the most I could figure out how to cram into that was adding 2 bits and 2 bits. But what's neat about this is, let's say that we're not trying to make an adder. Let's say we're trying to make, what else could we make? Something that computed the max. So let's imagine we've got 5 people, and each of them gets to vote for candidate 0 or candidate 1. Okay, so we've got 3 votes for candidate 1 and 2 votes for candidate 0. So let's say that what we want is to create a circuit that would take these bits as input, and then would basically tell you who won the election. Right? That's a perfectly reasonable logical circuit. We ought to be able to, I don't know how many instructions it would take to do this, but I could work out what those instructions were. It'll either fit in 32 bytes or it won't. If it does, though, we could then execute. We can start off the values A through E the way we wanted them, step through it, and at the end of that procedure, it will actually tell us who won. The circuit doesn't have to change. My interface doesn't have to change. All that has to change is I reach into the memory cell, so like this one here. If I change it from 51 to, say, 101, the command changes, right? It actually interprets that number that I put in as a command. Put in different sequences of numbers, I get different commands. It can do different things. That's a computer. Gives you chills. All right. So what I'll probably do on the next homework is come up. This is somewhat complicated. It takes 32 bytes to specify the program, but I'll give you a shorter program that we can put in. And you can step through, and it'll calculate something else. But it'll be the same machine doing the work. You good? Okay. All right. So, what's neat about, so now I didn't show you what was happening on the inside yet. All I said was, we can take an idea we have, like computing the winner of an election. We could turn it into a sequence of steps, all these tiny little steps that are just adding and oring values in a bunch of variables. We can encode those as sequences of bits, and we can put them into my interface and it'll actually execute them. But if we wanted to put that in a real computer, a real box, a real machine that was doing this, we actually have to specify what are the circuits that cause it to actually execute these instructions. And it turns out that almost all computers use the same basic idea. And the idea is due to John von Neumann, who, I want to say he was in New Jersey. Does anybody know where von Neumann did his thing? Let's just say New Jersey, because, you know, New Jersey's cool. So he came up with this idea, that said, hey, wait a second, we can make these very general processors by just thinking about state machines, just like in the Christmas light example that I gave. But what's going on inside is exactly interpreting accumulators and PCs and instructions and so forth. So here's the basic idea. It's just a big circuit that takes as input the value, the current value of the registers, the current value of the program storage and memory, and maybe input devices if you want to be able to talk to it. It produces as output, after things have flowed through ands and ors and nots and stuff, it comes out the other side, the new value for the registers, the new value for the memory, anything that needs to be sent to the output device. There's also a program counter that it keeps track of. I guess that's part of the input and the output. So what instruction are we currently doing? What instruction are we doing next? And then, after it actually does all that, whatever the answers are get fed back up to the beginning, and it just does it again. But because, for example, the program counter might have changed and the value of the memory might have changed, it'll do something different the next time through. And what the cleverness is sequencing, setting up the instructions so that by running this cycle over and over and over again, useful work comes out the other end, little by little. All right? So this cycle box for my computer, it's 246 bits that come in, 246 bits that come out, and then we just take those bits and we copy them back up to the top and do it over and over and over again. This box that I'm calling cycle, some people call CPU, central processing unit. It's the kind of the circuitry heart of the computer. It's the thing that actually does the work. But what is it doing? It's just taking bits, smooshing them around, producing different bits, feeding them back up to the top, and just doing that over and over again.
Von Neumann was at the Institute for Advanced Study.
Which is in Princeton. So Von Neumann did this stuff in Princeton, in New Jersey. So you can just kind of, right, you know, feel the computer science flowing through you. All right, so in terms of my particular instruction set and the little boxes that I chose to make it out of, this is the whole computer written as circuits. Now these circuits have sub-circuits in them. We've talked about that sort of idea before. We can actually go inside this memwrite 16 times 1 that's actually holding onto the register values and allowing you to change them. You go a level down and another level down and it's just ands and ors and nots. Okay? It would be as ugly as it already is, it would be much uglier if I did it all in terms of ands and ors and nots on the screen. But it's just mechanical to turn it into that. There's no thinking that happens at that point. So we could just, potentially, we could just push a button and it would actually produce the circuit that would do this work. We could then, if we had enough money, we could send it to some fabrication place. They would give us this on a chip, they'd give it back to us, we'd be able to, I don't know, connect a keyboard to it and some lights, and it would actually have a working device. Now, I should probably figure out how many ands and ors and nots it takes to do this, but it's probably on the order of a couple thousand, maybe 10,000. Modern computers, the number of ands and ors and nots is on the order of hundreds of millions, getting up towards billions, which is more than I probably could do. That's not my strength. But again, at the lowest level, it's just doing this idea, but on a larger scale. All right, so I said that I was calling my little instruction set here, what did I call it? I think it was Michael Lippmann's Mini Logic Machine Language, or MLQ'd. I designed it so that it would fit on a slot and could at least handle 2-bit addition. If it couldn't handle 2-bit addition, I would have changed it so that it could. I iterated a couple times. And computer manufacturers do this as well. They make up what instruction set are they going to make the computer chip actually run. And then any high-level thing that anybody does has to be turned into that eventually. And we're going to talk about that probably the beginning of next week, how you take a higher-level program and turn it into these tiny little instructions that a computer can actually execute. Now, they have a different goal in mind. They're not trying to make their spit on a slide or be easy to understand. They're worried about cost and speed, how fast is it going to be when it runs modern programs. And so they end up with very different instruction sets than mine, at least in the details. So I'm going to just show you a couple different instruction sets. This is the x86 instruction set. Any hacker that grew up in the 80s did some amount of work in this. This is what Intel chips used to run pre-Pentium. But I think the echo is in the Pentium instruction set of this history. But you know, it's just instructions, just like the one that I created. So let's they're just nasty. So clear carry. So there's a special bit. Remember, I had the program counter, I had the accumulator. They have some other special registers like the carry bit. So they have one command that when you execute this command, just clears the carry bit, sets it to zero. So that's one of the things in the instruction set. Another one. Logical AND. It takes some memory location is input and does an AND, just like in line. So that's not so different, but it has a bunch of things that I didn't have, like set if NOR equal set if NOR 0. In other words, set me, set is. And anyway, so to be able to program at this level, you have to actually get a really good feel of what commands are available and how to use them. And very few people write programs at this level anymore. There's programs that automatically take easier to write programs and then turn them into this. Then they get loaded on the computer, then the computer runs them. The first instruction set that I learned was for a chip called the Z80, which was in the, back when Radio Shack had their own computer, pre-Dell, anything like that. And so these are the commands that were available online. You can see a lot of them are really similar to each other. A lot of these LD stands for load, same ideas as load in my instruction set. It's taking some, doing some instruction and storing the value in the accumulator. There's also stores, I think. There ought to be. No, not so much. There's resets, though. Push and load, and anyway, so there's a bunch of different commands, and there's a whole lot of different ones. Obviously, you need a more complicated cycle circuit to decode and execute these statements, but again, in principle, it's not really all that different. I was telling a friend of mine who I used to work with about the fact that I made up my own instruction set. He said, "Oh, do you know about cardiac?" And I said, "Do you think I'm going to have a heart attack?" And he said, no. Way back when at Bell Labs, there were some people who wanted to explain how instruction sets work to students, and they came up with a computer instruction set that you can execute entirely in cardboard. So you write the program with your pencil in the little boxes, and then you pull this little card, and it causes things to scroll, and it tells you what to do. You actually do the work, but it says, okay, take whatever's in the A box and add it to the B box and write the answer in the C box. So you do that, and you execute the program, and then it does something cool on the other side. So I just thought that was neat, and I actually have this. If anybody's fascinated with computer history, I actually have the cardboard version of this, which I scanned in. It's just
funny.
All right, so that was it for instruction sets. What I'd like to do now is pop up a whole other level and say, all right, now we've got to talk about how people really write programs, and then we'll bridge the gap between how people write programs and how computers actually execute programs. But first, I want to say a little bit more about how people write programs. Any other questions about instruction sets or machine language before I move on to that? You good?
Okay. See where we are. All right, good. No, not that. Oh, right, for this I need sound. I forget how to do sound. That doesn't look good.
There's another thing that looks like it takes a stereo cable, but it looks like you need a stereo cable for this.
Well, I can crank up the volume on this guy. Not very much, though. All right. See you next.
All right, so let me try to put where we are now into a larger context. So up to this point in the semester, we talked a little bit about physical bits, zeros and ones. They can be stored with high and low voltage in a modern computer. But we also talked about, it sort of doesn't matter. You can do the same sorts of things with water pressure and kinetic energy, moving of things. Based on these ideas, you can create simple logic gates, things like AND, NOR, and NOT. If you set the lower level up right, you can create ANDs and ORs and NOTs that manipulate that lower level and do whatever kinds of logical functions you want. Mostly, we've talked about ANDs and ORs and NOTs. A lot of modern computers are actually based on things like NOR and NAND, which is not OR and not AND. The reason being that you can actually, with just with NOR all by itself, you can make AND and OR and NOT, and therefore anything. So it's kind of neat. One gate is really all you need if it's the right gate. So, and in some sense, that doesn't matter. This level doesn't have to care about how the bits are implemented, and the level above it doesn't have to care about how the gates are implemented, as long as we have all the ones we need, AND and ORs and NOTs and various combinations. So the next level up, we can create logic gates. We can create things like circuits that actually compute whether two things are equal, or that let certain values through depending on whether something's true or false, or interpret the bits as digit sequences and add them together and produce the sum. All these were is created out of various combinations of ands and ors and nots. And when we did this, when we thought about how to do that, we didn't care about how the ands and ors and nots were created, as long as we could create one when we needed it, where we needed it. All right? Above that, I showed how you could take these ideas and create an instruction set, a machine language instruction set like the ML cubed that uses these various gates to actually act like a computer and execute some very simple statements. It turns out on top of that, you can, and this is coming later, we can take a high-level language like Python or Logo or C++ or Java or JavaScript. There's a bunch of different ways of writing programs in a way that's a little easier for people to think about. And then a computer can actually convert it down to this level. When you're thinking at this level, you don't have to care about the details of how the instruction set's implemented, as long as it's powerful enough to implement any of the kinds of statements you've got. We can now go up another level and say, all right, now that we've got a high-level programming language, it doesn't directly do all the different things that we want. We'd like to kind of package a whole bunch of little programs together so that we can implement more complicated programs. And these are called software libraries. And you might have libraries for doing graphics or animation or robotics that are then built on top of a higher level language, which are built on top of the machine language, which is built on top of the logic gates, which is built on top of the basic logic, built on top of the physical bits. It all just works together because the interface between each of the levels is sufficiently simple. So what I would like to get at with the lecture that I'm just starting now is a little bit about this border here. How do you take little programs in one language and use it to create more complicated programs? And this is the notion of subroutines. Now, you should be very glad to know that the Beatles song, I was going to make another spoof song based on the Yellow Submarine from the Beatles about some kind of fellow subroutines, but it didn't happen. So you've been spared. But nevertheless, we do have some Beatles music coming up shortly. All right. So in Hillis's book, the way that he demonstrated the notion of subroutines is by creating different logo programs that do things like, here's four boxes together, and the way you get four boxes together is by making a subroutine that does one box and making four of them. And that's fine. I just never was a big fan of turtle drawings on screen. So I have a different idea of how to try to get this idea across if you don't quite have it yet. Because I feel like this is an area in which everybody's already spent a fair amount of time researching it. And that's songs, so sing-along programs. So this is the Gilligan's Island theme. Don't go familiar with Gilligan's Island. Okay with that? Some of us may have seen some of your songs. Some of us may be professors because we watched this show at an impressionable young age. Alright, so if you try to... So here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about programs, creating programs that when you run them, output the lyrics of different songs. Now, I started with Gilligan's Island because there's really not much interesting here. And we're going to build up to more and more interesting songs. So, basically, what this program is going to have to do is print each line of this song to the screen. There really isn't much else you can do. See, it's got the professor in it. All right, so here's the Gilligan's Island theme song as a Python program. So here's what we do. Here's how we say this in Python. So we start off by saying def, which I think means something, but it's actually an abbreviation in this case for define. So we're defining a new command that this language is now going to have in it, in addition to whatever commands it already had. And this command, I'm going to name it Gilligan's Island. The Gilligan's Island, if we ever tell it to do the Gilligan's Island thing, here's what it's going to do. Here are the steps. The first thing is going to print to the screen, just sit right back and hear a tale of fateful trick. It's going to do that, then it's going to move on to the next statement, which is another print statement that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. And anyway, to spare you the details, it's going to do that once for each line of the song, and then it's going to end. Okay? This whole thing, this def followed by all these print statements, basically just tells the computer, don't do anything, but if anyone ever asks you to do Gilligan's Island, that's what you should do. Do this sequence of instructions. So, of course, the next thing I do is I say, okay, I'll name that tune, do Gilligan's Island. So I tell it to do that, It prints out the lyrics, and that's the whole thing. Alright? So this is already, it's not so interesting, but it's a little interesting because basically what it's saying is we're going to have this programming language. The only statement maybe that you know in this language so far is print. Print tells it to take whatever's between these quotes and write it out to the screen. But now we can tell it, and there's another thing you can do. You can also do Gilligan's Island. That gives us a way of creating a higher level idea out of some smaller level ideas. All right, but that's not that interesting. This is a little more interesting. All right, so this is the song Clementine, which I believe everyone should be familiar with. If not, you will find it quite disturbing. And in fact, if you're familiar with it but never really sang it all the way through to the end, you will find it quite disturbing. We'll read the first verse, the chorus, and then the last verse. So in a canyon, in a cavern, excavating for a mine, dwelt a miner 49er and his daughter Clementine. Nice guy with a nice daughter, all right? Oh my darling, this person's thinking, oh my darling Clementine, thou art lost and gone forever. Wait a second, we just met her. Dreadful sorry Clementine. Anyway, eventually, she's gonna be walking around, she's gonna fall into the water, and she's gonna drown, and the singer of the song didn't save her because, I'm sorry, I don't have a song. So sad. All right, and anyway, how I missed my Clementine, but I kissed her little sister and forgot my Clementine. That's hideous. I didn't realize how awful this song was. But anyway, there it is. Now, why is this interesting? Apart from what the heck were these people doing in the 1800s? So we could, just like in the Gilligan's Island case, we could create a Clementine program, and we can do it just the same way we did with Gilligan's Island, right? Just starts off, we say, jump on the chair, then we get up on the chair, we say, Death Clementine, create a new command in the language called Clementine. If I ever tell you Clementine, here's how you have to do it. Print, in a cabin or in a canyon, excavating for a mine, built a miner 49er, his daughter Clementine. Print by itself just makes a blank line, turns out. So it's going to print a blank line, then it's going to print, oh my darling, oh my darling, oh my darling, Clementine, thou flushed and gone forever, dreadful sorry Clementine, though not that sorry, it turns out. Then it prints a blank line, then it prints the next verse, then it prints a blank line, then it prints the chorus again, then it prints the blank line, prints the next verse, and so forth, goes all the way to the end. And when this is all over, when we're finished our definition, we can now tell the computer, hey, Clementine, and it'll go and it'll print all the lyrics. Okay? We good? So why is this not good design, right? Why is this kind of not the way that you'd really want to do this? Well, there's this tremendous repetitiveness going on here, right? We've got that, which just looks like that, which looks just like that, which looks just like that, and then we, of course, end up with another one. So it seems sort of silly that we're using the same sequence of statements over and over and over again. Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice if we could just say, and then do the chorus again? And of course we can, because we can create subroutines just like this Clementine. We can also create a subroutine called Clementine Chorus. So, Death Clementine Chorus. Create a new command in the language called Clementine Chorus. Whenever anybody tells you the Clementine Chorus, here's what you need to do. Print a blank line, then print the lines of the chorus, and be done. Okay? Now, any time that we need to sing the chorus, we just say Clementine Chorus, and it should do the right thing. So let's see. So here's how it looks now. We define the chorus, and then we define Clementine that says, in a canyon, in a cavern, excavating for mine, built a mine of 49ers, daughter Clementine, then do the chorus. How does it know how to do the chorus? We already told it how to do the chorus. Okay? Print the next verse, do the chorus. Print the next verse, do the chorus. Print the next verse, do the chorus. Print the last verse, do the chorus. And now when we tell it to Clementine, the output will look just like it did the other time I defined Clementine. Right? It's the same sequence of events is going to happen, but the way that it does it is by calling its own little sub-programs, its own little subroutines, whenever it comes to the chorus. So why are we doing this way? I mean, one of the reasons is because it makes it clear what's going on, right? It's not that every time we get to the chorus we sing a different thing, we sing the chorus. And so what does this let us do? Well, it simplifies the program. The program itself is shorter now, because every time we had that whole chorus, we just had now a single line. It's easier to maintain. What if it turns out that I actually had a typo in the chorus? In the other version of the program, I'd have to fix it every time it appeared. Now, I can just fix it in the subroutine definition, and it'll be fixed. When I run the whole program, it'll be fixed everywhere. That's kind of cool. It's easier to extend it. What if we wanted to add a few more verses with a few more choruses? That's easy. We just put the verse, just say, do the chorus, put the verse, do the chorus. Easier to fix in a way that I said before. So this is better. This is sort of a nice way of doing things.
It's not remarkably powerful, but it gives us something that we didn't have before. All right. So here's how it actually executes, right? So in a cavern, canyon, in a cavern, excavating for a mine, built a miner, 49er, and his daughter Clementine. Then it calls the chorus. So that means now the next instruction that it's going to execute is the one that's the first instruction in the definition of the chorus. It prints the blank line, it prints the lines of the chorus, and when it's finished doing that, it goes back to where it was. It remembers where it left off and jumps back to there. Picks it up from there. All right, so
here's another Beatles song. I had to stare at this one for a long time before I figured out which subroutines I kind of liked for it. So what do you think? The Beatles are funny. They're not as obvious as a lot of other songwriters. They're sort of subtle. Turns out Beatles songs are hard to buy in iTunes. You know? It's this whole fight over the fact that their music label is called Apple, and Apple runs iTunes. And when Apple wanted to be Apple, the Apple record label said, that's not okay, and Apple, the computer company, said, we're a computer company, we have nothing to do with music. That's a true story. Now they actually do have something to do with music, and they're pissed at each other. So there are, you can't get Beatles songs on iTunes. I would have not done the cheesy version. Any votes for where we can find a chorus in here? We can find a subroutine, is that a thought? The and I'll send all my love to you, I'll pretend I'm kissing the lips I'm missing, like that. And oh, the next, that and I'll end. Alright. And then while I'm away, and then we have it here again, and then while I'm away, we have it here while I'm away. That's pretty good, we get a little savings from that. So let's see if that's what I thought. Well, I found that first. There's a bigger chunk that is repeated twice. But then, okay, right, so you can do that. Is that all I did? And then I noticed what you noticed. So what's interesting here is now we have this big blue subroutine that gets repeated twice in the song. And within that, there's a little block that actually gets repeated someplace else. So now you can actually go a little further and say, hey, what if we actually define two levels of subroutines? We'll have the three-line one that you noticed, that, and while I'm away, I'll write home every day and send all my love to you. Then close your eyes, the big blue one, we'll define this way, and as part of it, we'll call the away subroutine. And then finally, the full song will do close your eyes, a couple more lines, do the away thing only, a couple more lines, do close your eyes, a couple more lines, and that's the song. So I'll pick it up next time with a little bit more about songs. Try to come with suggestions for interesting songs. I won't sing them, but you can analyze them.